views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to the Conscious Business Radio Network on Transformation Talk Radio. This episode, we are mixing it up a bit, and I am airing a roundtable discussion that originally aired on Threshold Radio with host Johnny Bluestar, and it included best-selling author Kenneth Ede and myself in a roundtable discussion. And the discussion focuses around Kenneth Ede's new book, Terror on Wall Street, and how his fictional story relates to real-world events and situations in America today. And what we did is we discussed the structural problems with the United States and the world economies, the future of the U.S. dollar, and its relationship with the world economy. It's a very timely discussion on a really important issue. And, you know, we look at the critical issues without propagandizing an impending collapse or doomsday event, which you see so much all over the internet, but rather by taking an urgent look and making sense of a very real situation that we find ourselves in. So I hope you appreciate this roundtable discussion.
Hey, this is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome back to Threshold Radio, broadcast from the Waywalker Studio at Vegas All Net Radio, or VANR. Today we are going to focus on Wall Street itself and its place in the U.S. economy. To this end, we're going to concentrate a bit on Ken Ede and Gordon L. Ede's new book called Terror on Wall Street. Gordon L. Ede was Ken's father and has recently passed away. While his father, Gordon, was still living, Ken began work on a largely nonfiction novel and at his request, turned it into a book of metafiction, a combination of nonfiction and suspense adventure story. Ken joins us in this discussion with Sarah Westall, a talk show host on a provocative and important program called Business Game Changers on the Conscious Business Network. She is an experienced technologist in computer science and internet infrastructures, as well as a consultant in entrepreneurial-oriented businesses. Her special interest is disruptive paradigms in business and technology that transform the world. Ken is an attorney, environmental, and human rights activist whose main avenue career-wise is working on several series of political and legal thrillers which focus on important social problems in America and the world. Terror on Wall Street, his book, seems particularly applicable now as the stock market's strange volatility is something that really can't be ignored. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Johnny. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. Ken, your book begins with a quote from no less a distinguished paradigm changer than Gene Roddenberry. Quote, "Our society is so fragile, so dependent on the interworking of things to provide us with goods and services that you don't need nuclear warfare to fragment us any more than the Romans needed it to cause their eventual downfall." Sarah, I hardly know a person that doesn't believe or at least fears some kind of impending financial collapse. I think it's fair to say that the U.S. and even the world economy is driven by a certain type of paradigm, one that has evolved in recent years. It involves the Federal Reserve, an array of central banks worldwide, the so-called quantitative easing or massive printing of currency, the regulation of interest rates, the International Monetary Fund, and various trade currencies, etc., etc. This kind of control over the economy started quite some time ago, but has advanced and kind of solidified over the past few decades. Wouldn't you say? How would you describe it in terms of its impactful, disruptive nature? And could it be, as many people think, quite negative and contributing to a potential collapse?
Well, I think there's it could contribute to a collapse, and there's a few reasons for this. I think the powers that be cannot outsmart the market. They don't know how to fix it. They are constantly tinkering in ways that are destructive, and the experts have varying opinions on what to do, which causes conflict. And there's just too much greed in the process. The Federal Reserve is owned by private banks, and their number one constituents are the owners of those banks themselves, not the U.S. people. And politicians, another problem is politicians do not understand economics, and their number one goal is to be reelected and liked by the people. So they make policy to that end. And after going off the gold standard, and this is one of the big reasons as well, after going off the gold standard, the dollar became a fiat currency. And the first few reasons that I described are the reasons why fiat currency will ultimately collapse, because history shows that fiat currencies have always collapsed. They're just inherently unstable because they don't have anything to tie it to create that stability.
Could we call this, maybe considering the amount of money that's being created, sort of a hyper fiat currency?
Well, it's like all fiat currencies, they become a hyper. That's why they collapse, because they become a hyperinflated currency, and then there becomes no value in them once there is that many dollars printed.
Right, the danger of hyperinflation.
Yes.
But still, in all, they are printing an awful lot of money these days without too much inflation so far.
Well, that's because they're printing on purpose to, and this is something I was going to talk about as well in the program, they're printing on purpose to because there's deflationary pressure right now. We're in a global recession, and so there's huge deflationary pressure. And so they want to, because of our debt and our situation, they have a 2.5% interest goal that they try to maintain every year. And by printing and monetary easing, they have pretty much maintained that inflationary goal. Although in some sectors of our economy, it's been way higher inflation than that, and other things have deflated, as we all know. The stock market, another thing that they did is, everybody lost their portfolios. And by doing this monetary easing and creating an inflationary pressure, it caused the stock market to go up. So people feel their portfolios are back to normal, which they aren't.
Well, Ken?
Yeah.
We've been speaking in broad generalities to introduce the problem. But could you describe the early setting of your book, which take us into the midst of a bloody terrorist attack, throwing American society into a complex, chaotic, and dangerous panic? Several of your characters, Snooki, a brilliant but rather detached woman, perhaps slightly out of touch with reality, and Ike Pendleton, a researcher specializing in neuroscience, are trying to get to Washington from Chicago, facing the reality of trying to survive in this rapidly deteriorating environment. Could you describe the scenes depicting this disaster in your novel?
Sure. In Terror on Wall Street, a terrorist attack on retail market chains causes a panic in the market as well as a run on the banks. And the attack is focused on the retail food supply, which is very delicate and volatile system because it depends on the prompt payment of invoices. I wanted to show how in this type of a collapse, how difficult simple things that we take for granted, like going to the grocery store, getting gas, and in this case, getting from point A to point B, Washington from Chicago, is a pretty easy thing. We could jump on a plane, we could jump in a car. But I wanted to show how difficult these simple things we take for granted would be if we're placed in this type of situation.
Forgetting for a moment the actual terrorist event, which in your book initiates the crisis, how do you think a financial collapse without that component could affect America? Would it have the same things exactly in your novel, the gas shortages, the bank problems, the looting? Or would it really mirror these scenes, do you think?
Well, I think a true crisis, financial crisis, like the type that was averted in 2008, if it would have played its way out, would be actually worse than a series of terrorist attacks. And these are the type of things that we can expect to happen. People feel safe if their money is guaranteed by the government, but with a massive bank failure, Where's that money going to come from to pay back all those FDIC guarantees? It's just not going to happen. The Federal Reserve, as Sarah mentioned before, has been pretty good at creating inflationary trends to minimize the national debt. That, you know, makes it easier for them to collect more money in taxes, and it actually makes them able to pay less debt back. But in a true collapse, it wouldn't be able to collect enough tax money to pay those debts. So I think I think the terror we'd actually see is worse than if we were attacked by terrorists.
So I'm going to ask you both. Do you think imminently there's an economic doomsday ahead of us, a stock market crash, a currency collapse, hyperinflation, anything that could radically change our lifestyle in that direction? Sarah?
Well, I do think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to – it'll be a doomsday type – I mean, it might feel like one in the months after it happens. But I think that just like it did in the Weimar Republic in Germany and in other countries, it – your country eventually restructures itself and there's a healthy cleansing and you come out on the other side.
With Hitler?
Well, that's a good example of what happens, though, is there can be a healthy cleansing and then there can be a rise because it's so radical. There can be a rise of all sorts of – but we're seeing that now. Look at the kind of politicians that we're seeing now rise.
Trump.
Yeah, I mean,
you have to listen to his debate, at least in the Republican arena.
Oh, it's actually hilarious. I mean, it's sad because it's very serious subjects, but it was probably one of the most entertaining shows I've seen in a long time.
Really?
Maybe more than that's the thing. That's the thing, though. Yeah, but that's the thing. It's the biggest multi-billion-dollar TV attraction. You know, every 4 years, and they've always thought the financial elite has always thought that they've had the edge on it because they've got the most money. But now we got someone who just comes up and basically with no money, just because he can command press, is taking control of the whole thing.
And what kind of a debate can you really have about these issues when you have 30 seconds to say something and maybe the same amount of time to follow up? I mean,
you add the entertainment factor into it.
But you can really call some names, some really good names in between the discussions.
You have to admit, there hasn't been another debate that has been like this. The past presidential elections have at least been, you know, they've been kind of mean to each other and things, but it's still had a level of professionalism. And this is just... It's at a whole nother level. It's really entertaining, but it's sad.
Yeah, it is really entertaining, I have to admit. We're going to go to a break now. Ken, I want to begin right now. Why don't you tell us how and why you helped your father with this book and why Gordon Ead would want to write a book like this in the first place?
Well, my dad, Gordon Ead, was what I would like to call a financial wizard. He was pretty much the opposite of me. I remember him saying he's been a saver all his life and he didn't know how to spend money. And I said, yeah, Dad, I know I've been a spender all my life and I don't know how to save money. But he was able to retire before he was 54 years old entirely on his investments. And he weathered all these financial crises and every crash that we've had since the 1970s. And every time I picked up this manuscript that he asked me to work on, I thought I couldn't do it. But as his Alzheimer's disease got worse, I focused on one of the main characters, which is Professor Mason. And I actually gave him early Alzheimer's. And that made me feel like my dad was a character in the book that was helping guide me with the story. It was kind of difficult and different than what I usually do.
Very poignant, though. There is a certain thread of certain personal, the personal foibles and characteristics of these characters that makes it very interesting, because you were trying to communicate not only the sort of terror of the situation, but actual concrete factual realities and theories about what can be done. Ike and Snooky, who we described as characters in your book, are trying to get to Washington. The purpose of their journey is to connect with a few classmates in a special workshop developed by Professor Harry Mason, who you just mentioned, who's been asked to give a presentation to the Senate Finance Committee. In fact, the workshop was convened with one main purpose, to save the world economy from total collapse. Ken, would you give us an overview of this workshop and how is it structured to actually save the world economy?
Sure. Without spoiling the story, Professor Mason has, for his graduate level study course, picked each of the students, handpicked them, each one that participates in the workshop, and each of them has been picked because they have a special talent in economics. One's a specialist in neuroeconomics, studying why the brain makes the decisions that it does. Another is an expert in computerized trading systems. Another one's a stockbroker. And he brings them all together as a team of experts to work on proposed legislation to give to the to our leaders of our country to try to solve what he feels are our main economic problems. And in the midst of this workshop, we have an actual economic crisis.
Well, Sarah, one of the functions of this emerging paradigm that I see is the government-enforced reliance on citizens' retirement being tied to Wall Street. Was it fair to provide pension plans that were based on stock portfolios to workers? Was it right to provide 401k retirement plans based also on stock to people wanting to safeguard their future? Give us an idea of what happened to these type of people, to people who wanted to retire, who wanted a savings in 2008.
Well, I think there's well-meaning people that wanted to allow average people to take advantage of the rise in the stock market that does happen. But what that also creates is these pension funds had huge amounts of cash in it. And so the people that, you know, the powers that be in that, we're a capitalist society, and they see that as a golden goose. You know, there's piles of monies. We need to go after that. And so there was a lot of pressure to get those funds to be used for all sorts of purposes. And and we saw the results of, well, so basically what happened with these piles of money is that there wasn't always ethical usages of them, right? And they, right. People just try to make money off what they can. And they don't see the bigger consequences of what they're trying to do. Some people do, and then that's just plain old criminal behavior. Other people just want to make money for themselves, and they just don't understand the bigger consequences. But, you know, one of the main effects of the quantitative easing and the money printing was to substantially rise the market and get their portfolios back to what they were, you know, back in 2008. Not everybody has seen that. You know, their portfolios rise to that level. People got scared and got out of the market and lost everything. But for those that stayed in, the substantial part of their portfolio has been, you know, re-intact.
Well, I have another question. You know, for a long time, I didn't have a savings account. I had a checking account, a corporate account, personal account, but I didn't really bother with a savings account. And then recently I went to a bank and I wanted to get a savings account, and I found out that the interest was rather low.
Yeah, it's kind of a joke.
What has really happened here? I mean, maybe it was a CD, 3-5% interest or something like that, you know, something that at least had a little meat on the bone. This didn't have any meat at all. It was just a few copper pennies. Why? How did that happen?
Well, are you asking me?
Yes.
Well, I wasn't sure if you wanted to talk to Ken now. Well,
I want to talk to Ken, but...
No, he's great. basically, banks need to make money, and they think that people put money into their accounts and they don't need to pay them. I mean, they know that people are not using it as investment vehicles. So, plus when... The banks, when the Glass-Steagall Act fell, you know, when it wasn't before that came back, but when they took away the banking regulations, which allowed banks to go into financial investments, what incentive is it to a bank who can also get the people into their financial investment products to allow a savings account to have good interest? All that does is motivate people to keep it in your savings account. They want people out of there and into their financial products.
So you're saying this was completely dictated by the greed of banks, and this had nothing to do with how they got money from the Federal Reserve or anything like that?
Well, I think the Federal Reserve getting money, I mean, I was, you know, from decades ago, it started a while ago where the interest rates on savings accounts have been low. But getting money from the Federal Reserve at such a low interest rate, that pretty much gave banks the ability to get money for free, right? They had investment money for free. It allowed them to make money off the government, off of us. But banks, we have to understand, banks are there to make money. I mean, we're kidding ourselves to think that banks are in the business to do anything else but to make money for themselves and their shareholders.
So, Ken, you agree with that, that this is basically a matter of greed, that they have deprived people from saving in the United States from saving without the risk of stock portfolios?
Well, I agree that it's a matter of capitalism. I agree with Sarah 100%. In fact, if you go into Bank of America and open a new account, while you're opening the new account, they'll send the Merrill Lynch guy over to talk to you.
Yeah, I understand that. But what I don't understand is why a poor person isn't able to save money in a relatively safe way anymore. That's depriving the American people of...
There's no return on safe investments. That's the problem.
You could put it in annuities. You know, things like that. Those are fairly safe, but you don't make any. You don't get an interest rate if the market doesn't go up, but you don't lose money either. You know,
You can do what my dad suggested, and that's play the whole market with index funds. But that involves a risk, but the risk is not as much as trying to figure out what the market's doing on your own.
Going back to the sort of general economy, particularly in the past recently, I'm asking this to both of you. In 2008, what do you think of the financial manipulations and the bailouts? How much validity was there in the, quote, solutions that they had? And how much was just really based on providing unfair advantages to certain big players and taking quite a few big businesses out of the game? Sarah?
Well, a financial collapse of a large institution such as Lehman Brothers did and will cause a collapse of the system unless, you know, we really intervene, which is what happened. Especially with all the derivative exposures. So, you know, unfortunately, bailing out those big firms is something that we have to do unless we have major structural changes where we break up those big banks. But I do think that they did play games and allowed certain members to fail and others not, because they're all competitors. We had the irrational ego game in the middle of that whole collapse, and then they got scared because they realized what they did, and then they had to save the system. That's what I think happened.
How about you, Ken?
I agree. I mean, I think what's happened is these banks have gotten too big, and if we lose one of them, it's going to be a domino effect, and we're going to lose all of them. This whole system's going to go down. Whereas if they had not been allowed to become so big, if you have a bank failure here or a bank failure there, it would be something that's isolated and easier to handle. But, I absolutely agree with her.
I think that there's one candidate, Bernie Sanders, who had said for sure that he would like to break up these big banks.
It's not going to happen.
Well, okay, I'm not saying it's going to happen.
Well, it's an example of the structural changes that need to happen and the courage of the politicians to do it. And I would have to agree with Ken that it won't happen. I think there has to be a major distress before we do it. You know, another 2008 type collapse where we don't have the ammunition and multiple banks are going to collapse, and then we'll be forced to do it because the banks have too much power. They're the ones running our world.
Well, here's a controversial question, Ken. In your book, you begin with one of your characters, Bob Bramman, a student but also a salesman at J.C. Morenson Securities, discovering a seemingly anonymous player shorting major amounts of transportation stocks as well as Walmart and other retailers. Later in the day, as previously mentioned, you describe how terrorist attacks on Walmart supercenters, key areas throughout the country, take place. There have been controversial discussions about the shorting of United and American Airlines stock prior to 9/11. Some commentators saying that although shorting happened and nothing to do with terrorists, while others say it actually happened that way. Do you think this kind of linkage has happened before in reality?
Well, yeah, I do, because one of the books that I used in my research when I did Terror on Wall Street was James Rickards, who wrote a book called The Death of Money. And in The Death of Money, he describes that a friend of his who's an expert said, oh, yeah, it was the biggest case of insider trading that I've ever seen in my life. And, you know, the people in the terrorist organizations were profiting from the terrorist attacks. And that was a reason why the government looked into doing forming a task force, which James Rickards was a part of, to work on a program to make a system to where we could see this coming and try to deal with it. Unfortunately, the government sacked the program, but Rickards was envisioning a hedge fund where terrorist groups would slowly and carefully make their investments for this very purpose, and this could contribute or actually cause a stock market crash of epidemic proportions. So I absolutely do believe in it.
You know, Harry's specialty, Harry Mason, in your book, was called Modern Portfolio Theory. And that, I take it, had a little bit to do with what your father actually did. What was that exactly, and how does it bear on Harry's mission and his theory for averting long-term disaster for the U.S. economy?
Well, modern portfolio theory is, you're right, it's what my father, Gordon Eade, based his investments on. And one of the, you know, that and was postulated as a theory by Harry Markowitz in the 1950s when he wrote a thesis on it that won him a Nobel Prize. And it was basically linking risk to return. And this theory was an efficient portfolio is one where no added diversification can lower the portfolio's risk for a given return expectation, and no additional return can be gained without increasing the risk of the portfolio. So one of the axioms of this theory is that current market prices are reflecting the total knowledge and expectations of all the investors in the market. And no one investor can consistently know more than the market does collectively. So my father's theory was to invest in index funds because the idea is that the best way to beat the market is to invest in the entire market without trying to figure out what particular part of the market is going to rally and what's not.
And he wanted to choose those indices very carefully, right? Because there are
there's a lot of them. But you know, the point is that these index funds are spreading risk over a large amount of securities, as opposed to mutual funds, which have different people picking, what stocks that they want to go with. So he was always a consistent investor with Vanguard. Basically, yeah. That's what he pitches.
Sarah, in Ken's book Terror on Wall Street, there's a lot of skepticism about the way the public is informed and advised by professional brokers as to how to handle their portfolios. Do you think in general the public is being ripped off? Is Wall Street basically unbeatable without very special knowledge?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. Well, we got to think of what a broker is, right? They're not very educated on the market. I don't think they fundamentally understand the majority of them. There might be a few here and there that are whizzes and they get it, but in general they don't, and their motive is to make money. So being ignorant and wanting to make money is a very dangerous combination, right? And then who their clients are pretty ignorant too. So it's just ignorance. And talking about what you were just talking about the index funds basis of the market, I mean, if you ever try to look at some of these stocks and – you know, I've had situations where I've invested in a stock that did amazing all through 2008. Profits were higher than, they just were doing stellar, but their stock was stagnant. And then other companies who should be bankrupt are just exploding. And that's the kind of irrational performance of these companies that turns a normal financial person who's been studying the market for a long time to go, man, I can't figure this out. I can't figure this out. We need to do something that's a smart index fund because over time it'll balance out. But it's so irrational that you got to go with a smarter plan.
You know, going back to 2008 again, do you both of you, do you feel there was a lot of criminality involved in this? It's often said that not one top executive or serious player was prosecuted. Wasn't there a bunch of fraud involved or mishandling of money? What do you think?
Absolutely. Wow. There's that going on. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard as a normal person, unless you're an insider. You know, that's why index funds are so important, because unless you're an insider, you don't know what games they're playing. You know, gold and silver have been manipulated since the dawn of time. You know, we just know they are, and there's some very, very obvious examples. But let's look at Goldman Sachs, how they manipulated the just the U.S. government to bail themselves out and made it. They had AIG got bailed out so that they could get paid 100% on their derivatives.
Right.
You know, that how they basically ripped off the American people. Or how about when they dumped toxic funds on their clients, unsuspecting customers, knowing that they were just trying to get out of those funds, knowing that those people would be destroyed by them. Yeah, that has to be criminal.
So what do you think of the fact that these people weren't seemingly prosecuted at all?
Well, I did a big show on it. I did a 2-hour, almost 3-hour show on it, on the lack of prosecutions of executives in Wall Street. And it's awful. that's the crux of some of our issues. The corruption is terrible. That's part of the reason why a collapse is a way of cleansing out the system, right? I mean, it's awful.
Well, right now, the markets – I'm sorry, Ken, go ahead.
No, I mean, after the 2008 crisis, we had a redistribution of wealth, and basically the losers were the American middle class. But the losers could easily, in a next crash, be the financial elite, because the whole system would be reset, and these people that have been artificially keeping their, you know, their casino betting the house's money in their own casino going for so many years could be the losers.
Well, that would be a nice situation. Nice outcome. I don't know.
Well, you know, looking at things right now, the market seems very vulnerable. The Fed says something, the price of oil changes, or some official says the oil price may change. The Japanese central banks approve negative interest rates. There's a slight change in employment or consumer buying in the U.S., and stock markets throughout the world go completely red or start to prosper powerfully for a few days. Are these tremors, guys, indicating perhaps an impending calamity, this volatility? Sarah?
Well, I think that it shows that we have a lot of just volatility in general. I mean, we're on the brink of World War III, right? I mean, we have all that buildup in Syria, 250,000 troops. The U.S. and Russia did some kind of truce of peace, but how is that going to work? Because they didn't bring the parties that are actually fighting to do the peace agreement. Mm-hmm. It's like me and you deciding that those two people over there are going to stop fighting. I don't know if that's really going to work. And the problem is they're Russia and the United States are the ones, you know, funding it. So there's just so much volatility all over the place. So the market is reflecting just the chaos everywhere. I mean, we got the debt, we got the wars, we got the fighting over oil. You know, there's all this energy alternatives that are popping up, but oil is the back of the dollar. It's crazy. And so, yeah, can it cause that? Yeah. Or can it just be, can the war kind of allow it to prolong longer? You know, it gives us something to focus on and invest our money in and helps the economy, unfortunately.
Ken, what do you think of these tremors, this volatility?
No, I agree absolutely with Sarah. And I think I think that behind every war the United States gets involved in, or every military conflict they like to call it, there's absolutely a profit motive. And, you know, as I exposed in my book to Russia for Love, the whole involvement of the United States in the Ukraine is all about backing our chemical companies for genetically engineered food and backing our oil and gas companies. And they've got people sitting on the board of the biggest gas company in the Ukraine that are the son of Joe Biden and John Kerry's godson. They're just blatantly just, you know, that's wherever you follow the U.S. war machine, you can bet there's money behind it.
In regards to the market itself, here is a very interesting explanation of how markets move, given by your character in Terror on Wall Street, whose name is Bob Braman. Market prices move on the basis of random events that become known throughout the day. Some of the events may have been anticipated by the market, while other events were not anticipated by the market and appear to be random. It is not at all unusual for the price to fall on a security when a dividend is raised or when a higher dividend was anticipated by the market. That's kind of the volatility that I was speaking of before. I'm focusing on the phrase move on the basis of random events. Ken, could you explain more about the term random in this context? Explain if the actual response to the random event that affects prices is rationally grounded.
Sure. Every trading day, billions of shares are trading. And most of those trades are going to occur on orders of professional traders, managers of pension funds and mutual funds and hedge funds and trusts. But the rest of them are transactions of individual investors who are investing for their own account. And during the trading day, these prices are going to move according to supply and demand of respective parties. And the publication of new developments and news of specific companies is immediately incorporated into stock prices. People really can't play the market. Normal people can't play the market unless they have inside information, because the market's already anticipated and digested and this news, and it's already incorporated into the price of the stock. So there's hundreds of thousands of investors competing with you, the average investor seeking to buy stocks that are undervalued or overvalued to buy at any instant time. Prices of securities are going to change when some unanticipated event occurs and investors react to this event. That's why it's virtually impossible to beat the market, because by the time you react to this trend on whatever random event it was, the market's already reacted to it and adjusted the price accordingly.
Well, I think one of the things that I found really interesting related to this kind of decision making, was Ike Pendleton's specialty of neuroeconomics. According to a website developed by the Society of Neuroeconomics, neuroeconomics is, quote, a nascent field that represents the confluence of economics, psychology, and neuroscience in the study of human decision-making. The Society of Neuroeconomics, according to their statement, quote, exists to foster research on the foundations of economic behavior by promoting collaboration and discussion among scholars from the psychological, economic, and neural fields, and to ensure the continued advancement of this field of neuroeconomics by supporting young researchers. I think it might be fair to say that this is an application or subdivision of cognitive science. Can you explain a little bit more about this, Ken?
Sure. It's the way you said it, it's like science meets economics. It's relatively new scientific discipline where scientists study how the brain makes decisions that involve taking and managing of risk, and they've focused on the limbic system for impulsive decisions that are made. And that's kind of like my dad's theory that Wall Street was aware of how the brain works and how it makes decisions. And every day as an investor, your sensory system is just bombarded with all this information that may or may not be beneficial to you as an investor if it's not properly evaluated by this ancient part of your brain. So the anticipation of receiving an award, like your senior portfolio go up 3 days in a row, like what typically happens in with an IPO that someone's bought into, because the law actually gives the underwriter the opportunity to legally manipulate the market to get this issue off. If people see that happening over a period of a few days, they figure, figure, oh wow, this is great. It's like a shot of heroin to a heroin addict. So this is the idea of the study of neuroeconomics, which is actually experimenting with animals and with humans to figure out how we make these risk reward decisions.
Well, partially that's because why it can be correlated with animals is because it's kind of instinctive behavior, and you're going for, in the human mind, I think you're going for narratives that make strong promises, and you're so attracted to those narratives that it's like an addictive substance, and it overrides your rational thinking. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's kind of yes. Go ahead, Sarah.
When he's saying ancient brain, there's a whole study called the reptile brain. And I had my class this year. We did a lot of stuff, or a big segment on marketing, tapping into the reptile brain. And it's really a big push in all business to figure out how to get to people's subconscious when you're marketing anything. And so Wall Street just jumped on that bandwagon and figured out how to do marketing and how to get to people's subconscious. And the interesting the interesting thing is taking it to another step and trying to figure out how to, because the market has always been very irrational. It's a very emotional beast. And the interesting thing is seeing if they can actually figure out the science behind it and see if there's patterns and something that you can figure out.
The other thing I wanted to say, Sarah, based on that, is the reverse is also correct, I think, and that's that the studies say that people don't want to lose their money, and so when you start to see a downhill trend, instead of riding it out, people will get in there and they'll sell, which is actually the time when people like Warren Buffett go in there and buy, but it causes a huge downslide. On this emotional sell-off.
Well, yeah, and you have to, in order to do that, you have to have a lot of cash on the sidelines, right?
Yeah,
because
true.
And so it takes a different type of, unless you're an actual investor in your life, and that's what you do for a living, it's hard for average people to have that kind of cash. They're living their life and letting their money just invest. And so, you know, it's hard for the average person because that's not what they do.
I think there's a correlation between this kind of instinctive thinking and the way the American people have accepted all the ridiculous aspects of the American economy, but also how they've accepted the political the political situation where they hardly feel the incentive to really vote in primaries at all. They don't really participate. They get some kind of enthusiasm during presidential elections, but they're not really taking responsibility for what's happening to them, which is a deterioration of their citizen and human rights right in their face. So it seems like they are being driven by sort of semi-conscious forces which promise things, but like security and safety or money and, security, but they're really not there at all. Those things are not there, and they're refusing to see them. Well, I'm afraid we're moving in towards the next hour. I want to thank both of you for our conversation so far, and I think we'll get much more deeply into Terror on Wall Street. Why don't you tell us something about how to get a hold of that book real quick?
Oh, sure. You can get Terror on Wall Street or any of the other nine novels I've written by going to Amazon.com, or you can go to my website, which is kennetheade.com, KennetheEade.com, and you can pick up Terror on Wall Street through a link there.
Terror on Wall Street, a book written by one of my guests, Ken Ead, with us today, is a lot more than a story of terror attacks by Middle Eastern terrorists. It is a story told in multiple ways of how Wall Street has inserted itself into the life of the American people, co-opting the way they save money, receive pensions, buy a house, invest in their retirement, and various other critical areas of their lifestyle. We're joined in this analysis of the present economic situation, partially as reflected in this book, by Sarah Westall, host of Business Game Changers on the Conscious Business Radio Network. Good morning again, Ken and Sarah.
Good morning. Or good afternoon, right?
Well, for me, it's still – well, yeah, you're right. It just moved into noon. I want to ask you, Sarah, you know, one of the reasons I brought you into this and I'm bringing you into some of our shows is the kind of thing that you do in Business Game Changers. I wonder if you could say a little bit about your program.
Well, my program brings – we talk about big issues, disruption, and innovation. So I bring on leaders and cutting-edge people in business and politics and society to really dive into the issues. For example, the person that I have coming on Monday was the commanding officer at the NYPD who was in charge of dealing with crises, and he dealt with 9/11, he dealt with Hurricane Sandy, whoa, and the 2003 blackout. So really great, you know, interview. And then the one I have on, I think I have it on right now with, I had Daniel Lentz, and then the World War III one right now with Bruce Gagnon. And he is an expert on military affairs and what's going on in how we dominate space with our military and how we win wars with that. He's just an expert on that. And then, I mean, I bring on experts in all different areas. I have had the chief strategist for J.P. Morgan, one who was in charge of all strategy for J.P. Morgan on. He comes on regularly to talk about what's going on with the markets. So that's what I do. I look for the best people I can find that really can get to the meat of it. And they might not be the most famous, but I try to look for the experts.
Well, that's good. And we're definitely dealing with a disruptive type of paradigm now, are we not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people don't know really what's going on. I had Gwyneth Shotwell on a few weeks ago, who's the president of SpaceX. And so much of what's going on, and people don't realize it, is the development of our military and space and how we're dominating in that direction. And we have, I think, 15 spaceports, and there's another 15, something like that, in the works right now. So what's going on there? There's just so many developments. And energy, you know, with oil backing the dollar, it's pretty crazy all the different things that are going on technology-wise and how that gap is not only displayed based on, you know, the wealth gap, which is very obvious in what we're talking about right now, but there's also a knowledge gap, which is pretty huge.
Well, you know, we're going to go into that right now. Just in response in regards to Wall Street, for the average investor who wants to get a good return, he's crippled by two elements. As Ike Pendleton tells Snooki in Harry's classroom in Terror on Wall Street, the book that Ken has written, let me quote. First, talking about the average investor who's looking for the money, first is his lack of information on how to invest in marketable securities, including his almost religious faith in what his broker tells him. A second problem lies in what goes on in his mind when he's faced with the decisions that must be made during the investment process. In my opinion, says Ike, I believe the worst enemy of the investor is that fellow whom he sees in the mirror as he shaves every day. Neuroeconomics is a relatively new field where economists study how the mind, specifically the limbic system, works to mislead us when we are confronted with sensory signals that take over our brains when we make financial decisions. Ken, we've been discussing this a little bit, but could you go more into the actual decision-making sequence that is determined by the activities of the limbic system as described by Ike?
Sure. I think if you just imagine yourself being confronted by your – not confront or being advised by your broker to go into an investment that has a potential for a very high return. The potentials for very high return come with higher risk, of course. So like Sarah said before, their average investor doesn't really have the cash to be able to handle these high-risk investments. But the broker, as Sarah mentioned, is basically a salesman trying to make money, and he doesn't really know what he's doing either. So if you're offering someone a high return, the studies in neuroeconomics have shown that people will take the risk to get more. So simply by offering this high risk investment that has the potential for the high return, the broker is appealing to your your emotional brain, and the limbic system is basically what's influencing you to make this decision rather than any rational factors that you should be considering.
Well, you know, we mentioned before that possibly the dynamics of the instinctive mind are also involved in politics. Does this, in either of your minds, does this in any way equate with the way people are relating to the candidates who are running these various campaigns and having these debates?
That's a great question. Well, I obviously there's something going on with both Trump and with
Rubio?
Bernie Sanders.
Oh,
well,
yes.
With all of them. Well, Rubio.
Yeah.
you have to laugh with that whole thing. I know Rubio is really upset with Trump, and it's back and forth. Rubio got pretty worked up over Trump, and Trump is just, you know, and I watched Cruz, and Cruz was really, for people who watched that, Cruz was more presidential, actually, than the way he reacted. He was trying not to laugh half the time because it was funny, but he didn't get worked up. But I mean, if you look at how people are backing Bernie Sanders, Trump, even Hillary Clinton, a lot of this is all emotional based, and they're marketing based on that reptile brain that we're talking about. They know that. That's what campaigns are now, because they, like you said earlier, you only have 30-second sound bites, so you're not getting into the depth. You know, most people aren't like us, really diving in, trying to understand things. Most people base it on those 30-second sound bites. So how are you going to sway somebody to vote for you unless you get to the marketing things that work?
Yeah, right? And this is basically, it's very much the same dynamic involved in any kind of advertising, right?
Exactly.
So we're kind of... Our politics, our consumer purchases are programmed by television, and now our consumer choices, our political choices are now controlled by television. So people have often compared our era to George Orwell's 1984. Where the actual consequences of all this programming leads to the complete eradication of any kind of freedom, any kind of citizens' rights. So it's rather a critical situation when so many people are controlled by their limbic system.
Well, yeah, and if you use their money to, you know, democracy, when it becomes fully mature, supposedly, this is the theory, is that you use their money to control them through propaganda and the media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're doing a good job.
Well, yeah. the rise of Donald Trump is a good example of propaganda being used, and the mainstream media is actually saying, what the hell's going on? Because they're not used to this. They're used to, you know, going with the mainstream politicians and how they control the media. And now we got someone who comes up and is using all these sound bites, like you said, and he's an expert at it. You know, throw the guy out. I mean, people are upset. They want something to happen, and he's offering that.
Well, and that's also the rise of the internet, right? And we're getting all sorts of different. So the mass media doesn't have full control over the media like they used to. So they're losing control with the internet. And then we also have, like you were saying, with Germany and when Hitler came aboard. I'm not comparing Trump to Hitler by any means, but it creates a extreme polarization. And so it creates a vacuum for someone to fill. People are thirsty, hungry for somebody to fill that vacuum for them. And so now you've got all these factors. They don't know what to do because we've never had an internet before, right? It's kind of a new renaissance of information. And then we have all this chaos going on in the markets and war and all these things. And so you get somebody like Donald Trump who just says it like it is, and he's not very polished in that way, but he's just saying it like it is. And I think people are just so hungry for truth and transparency that they're following him, you know?
Yeah, I've noticed.
And
this is Johnny back with Sarah Westall and Ken Ead discussing the problems that we have about Wall Street. As an example, one of the great problems is described very powerfully in a new film called The Big Short, was the way the mortgage industry contributed to the basket of Wall Street greed that eventually blew up in America's face. Did either of you guys or both of you see The Big Short?
Yeah, I saw it. That was a great movie.
I thought so. I saw it twice. I got to recommend it to you, Ken.
It's actually funny. I laughed so much.
I really enjoyed that movie. It sort of confirmed everything I think about reality now.
He comes walking. There's a bubble. Do you remember they went to check out in Florida to see if there was a bubble, and he comes like, there's a bubble. You would like that movie. That was he's the guy from The Office.
They're going to houses, to see what's going on with these houses that are not, mm-hmm. Having trouble moving, and people are leaving, and,
And the stripper
who was looking for a stapler in The Office, right?
Oh, no, that's The Office movie. You know The Office with, what is his name?
Oh, yeah, yeah, The Office TV show, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Got it. I should know his name. It's escaping me right now.
At one point, it became fashionable to ignore the reality of mortgage borrowers' pocketbooks, and loans for housing became extraordinarily easy. Further, the houses were bought and sold quite easily, eventually inflating the prices of real estate to an extremely high level. Then Wall Street took these loans and securitized them, bundling up into nice little packages. These packages were then sold as securities. Further, as I understand, these packages then were protected by derivatives, a kind of insurance in the form of security that protected the investor from a default on these packages, like a security inside of a security inside of a security. This type of collaboration between the real estate industry and Wall Street led to catastrophic results for America and helped contribute to a worldwide catastrophe in 2008. Is anything like this going on now, Ken?
Well, yeah, the same type of thing is going on. The big time bomb right now is derivatives, as you've mentioned.
What is the figure on that? I've heard some extraordinary figures about how much is going on money-wise.
The notional amount's like over $700 trillion, which is almost 10 times the worldwide gross domestic product. And, the banks don't even have the assets to satisfy a failure like that.
Sarah,
it's just mind-boggling. Yeah, it's still going on, and in fact, they've taken it up a notch. I mean, they're doing it on different products and now too, not just home mortgages. So it's—I don't know. We don't learn. I guess if you bail out the banks and you bail out their derivatives the first time, they don't. They have to learn the hard way, right? And I also think a lot of people just want to make money. The one thing I noticed in The Big Short, which was really a really good, well portrayed, is how they showed the revolving door between the government agencies that are supposed to regulate and the investment houses. And they showed how not only did they not regulate, they don't even really know. They weren't really on top of what they were supposed to do, and they were more interested in getting in with the big firms so that they can get a leg up on their own career. And mm-hmm. I really think that is, and that's what's happening not only at the top levels, but all the way through the system, right? And all the different levels. And that's the scary part.
It's happening at every level of industry. The revolving door is the phenomenon where the industry is actually regulating itself. And so instead of regulation, we have easing of regulation that allows industry to make more money.
Yeah. And
we've got, for example, in the chemical industry, we've got the EPA and the FDA, which are basically controlled by the chemical companies now because of the revolving door.
Well, and it gets worse when the FDA is, for medical purposes, the FDA is controlled by pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
And when the pharmaceutical, the big investors are on the boards of the medical schools. And so, there are a lot of good people in the system. My sister's a doctor and there's more doctors now in seeing psychiatrists and getting help because they can't really,
because keeping them from committing suicide.
because they can't take care of their patients the way they want to. And so they're in this awful situation where they are not being able to care for patients. And so it's really causing distress amongst them, because most of them are not in it for greed. Yeah, sure, they might have went in it because it's a good salary and stuff, but most of them get in there and want to care for patients, but they're not able to.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I would say that the limbic system may play a part in some of the medical education. Because what do you think when you hear a pharmaceutical commercial, and while they're showing the people on swings and having barbecues and having a great time getting well, when they're discussing at least, you know, two ways that they can get crippled, paralyzed, or completely killed by the end of the commercial.
Yeah.
So, oh, yeah, I want that, man. I want to get rid of my insomnia. I might die in my sleep, or my arm might fall off.
There is a place for that, right? I mean, if you have a crippling disease, you'll take the risks. But it's when we're not looking at, we're throwing out and not putting funding towards things to solve the problems in the first place, you know, to get to the source of the problem, because there's no money in that. That's where the issues are.
Well, I'm pointing out to the fact that the advertising, as graphic as this discussion is still powerful enough to program these people to thoughtlessly go out and buy some of these things that they shouldn't buy. And then the lawyers come on the advertising how they can get compensation from them. Sorry, go ahead, Ken.
No, I think you're talking also about the fear factor. I mean, it's a big motivation in a lot of what we're doing now is, you know, we're giving up our civil liberties because we fear we're not safe, or we fear we're going to get this and that. So we need a drug to, instead of eating right, we're trying to find the drug that's going to solve the latest symptoms.
Yeah.
I want to get back to the real estate crisis as presented in your book. In this case, it's presented by Snooki, but then further supplemented by Carlos Rodriguez. I'm not saying it properly, but anyway, he's another character in the book. Quote, Snooki says, "Whenever you guarantee a loan, you also open an opportunity for a capitalist to figure out a way to profit from the guarantee. Anyone who knows anything about investing knows that the higher the risk, the higher the expected return. Before we knew it, Wall Street was offering securities based on these guaranteed loans," which is what we've been talking about. Carlos then says, "That's right. Whenever you start out offering a situation without risk, you attract the attention of Wall Street and the financial services industry. Banks, for instance, under the Glass-Steagall Act, were prevented from getting into the housing finance business. Banks lobbied for years to have this restriction removed, and after 20 years and some $300 million later, they succeeded. The $300 million they spent bought the votes they needed to repeal the legislation." Is that just fiction?
No, it's not. No, it's absolute fact.
It's a pretty amazing. $300 million, 20 years later, and what I think maybe one of the greatest flaws or, you know, in our system, the greatest cracks in our system was developed by that destruction of that Glass-Steagall Act. What do you think?
Well, I agree. And, you know, we've got people like Hillary Clinton talking about bringing that regulation, those regulations or some form of them back, which, you know, I think probably needs to happen. It's probably one of the reforms that we need to have.
Well, one of the most interesting things about our economy is the massive printing of money by the Federal Reserve. In Harry's classroom, the class discusses the problem. Harry says, "I had a front row seat in 1998 when Wall Street bailed out the failing hedge funds. We missed the bullet back then, but we never learned, because 10 years later, as a result of the burst of the housing bubble, the big banks were on the verge of failure. But we just printed more dollars and bailed them out. We won't be able to print ourselves out of this next crisis, I'm afraid. Sarah, give us a bit of a picture of the policy of quantitative easing, a euphemism for the printing of massive money that's been going on for years. And do you think that it's going to end, the value of that, at some point?"
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the whole point of fiat currency, is that the value ends when you print so much that it no longer has value, right? Well, people, money only has value because we say it does, right? Now, a fiat currency. Whereas a non-fiat currency that's backed by something, let's say it's backed by gold, or it can be backed by anything of value. If you have, let's say you have 100 pounds of gold and you have $100, and that's a direct correlation, then each dollar is worth a pound of gold, right? That's not that's I'm just trying to explain how a regular currency is backed by gold. With fiat currency, right now there's nothing backing it. So if you just keep printing it, eventually people are going to be like, well, this doesn't have any value anymore. Because, you know, if you look at supposedly the assets of the United States is backing our currency, our fiat currency. That's what they say, the full faith of the United States government. But if you keep printing it to the point where there's trillions of dollars, and the assets get chopped up to such little pieces, each dollar has no value anymore. Does that make sense?
Does it mean that I'll have to take a big barrel full of money to get it, just a few potatoes?
Well, I mean, that's what they had to do in the other area. When fiat currency explodes, when it collapses, that's what happens, because they can't raise the value. They can't print them fast enough. And so, like, people would pay for their dinners in Germany. They would pay for their dinners before they ate, because by the end of the dinner, it would be, like, twice as much.
You know, Sarah, a lot of people speak about, including the Fed, the so-called value of inflation. And some pretty strange things happen in Germany because of it. What do you think about the reasons for the inflation in Germany before, right after World War One?
Well, I think there's could be a lot of correlation to today. And if you recall, we all know that Germany lost World War One, and the Allies put in place a treaty that made Germany pay for the damages that occurred all over Europe, and you know, due to the war. And it was thought that it would take them a century to pay off those debts. Right, for Germany too. So in order for Germany to get out of that problem, I mean, they don't want to be slaves to the world for 100 years, right? And to get out of that problem, if they hyperinflate their currency, then they can get out of that problem very quickly, right?
Because the value of the money is so much, there's a lot of money that they can pay, but it's worth much less.
Yeah, so let's say that they owe $1 million, but they only have 1,000. Well, let's inflate our dollars to 1 million, and then we just pay it off, even though it's worthless. But at least we can pay off our debt. And what happened, though, is there was a lot of consequences to that internally, because the people in the know, the people with the money, they figured out how to safeguard their own assets. And they came out of it well off, right? They just converted their money to different currencies and things. The problem is the average German person lost everything they had. And so that created an environment that was, that's what created the environment that was ripe for the rise of Hitler, right? When you have a lot of desperate people. And the reason why the Jewish people were so persecuted were because they were the class that they were such a small percentage of the population, but they had, and like they were 3%, I think, of the 1%. They were a very small percent of the population, but they had 98-99% of the owned of the, you know, big corporations, the banks and the financial sector. So they came out, majority of those people came out of it okay. Now the average Jewish person did not, you know, they were just like normal people. They didn't have any part of that. They're not wealthy like the, you know, they were just like every other person. But, and we can't mistake it. One thing I want to say is anybody in that position, whether they're Jewish or not Jewish, or whether whatever nationality they are, people who are in power, who own the banks, who own the big, large corporations, are going to figure out how to protect themselves and get themselves out of problems, right? So it's a mistake to pin it on one race of people or one nationality. But that's what happened. And so it rose, you know, it created that perfect storm where Hitler rose. But we're in that same situation with the extreme debt. And how do we get out of our debt problems? And it's almost a worldwide phenomena of how do we get out of our world.
Well, that's partially the reason for the printing of all this money.
Yes,
it,
exactly.
It hasn't actually reached the point where the American people are really feeling the power of inflation, but rather maybe more like deflation.
Well, it's because of the deflationary pressure that's going on because of the recession. Inflation hasn't happened, but it will. I mean, it's only a matter of time.
You know, Lord Keynes went to the peace conference that was resolving some of the problems after World War I, and he said this. This is Lord Keynes. Lenin is said to have declared that the best way to destroy the capitalist system was to debauch the currency. By a continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate secretly and unobserved an important part of the wealth of their citizens. By this method, they not only confiscate, but they confiscate arbitrarily. And while the process impoverishes many, it actually enriches some, like you were talking about, Sarah. The sight of this arbitrary rearrangement of riches strikes not only at security, but at confidence in the equity of the existing distribution of wealth. So
exactly.
In this case, people are using capitalism, then it actually paves the way for something really dangerous. In our case, maybe some kind of corporate fascism, which is, corporate fascism and communism in the most, in a sort of Stalinist sense, they're very close to each other. You know, whether the state owns supposedly everything and there's a communist class or there's just a few corporations that control everything, it really kind of feels the same at the very bottom.
Once you become extreme fascism, right, when the corporation's extreme, because then they keep innovation from occurring. I mean, we're seeing in certain, like the pharmaceutical, what we talked about, if we have innovations in certain medical fields, they don't allow that to occur. Or if we have energy alternatives, they're not allowing that to occur. And so that's where, the technology field, there's a lot, all sorts of innovations because there isn't a stronghold on that yet. But we're seeing it in a lot of industries.
Well, in Terror on Wall Street, the class presents its case to the Senate Finance Committee. I think it's really interesting, a really interesting scene. Snooki, after hearing a long, winding speech, speaks rather irreverently to the chairman of the committee. She says, "Let's face the facts. This financial collapse has been a long time coming. The banks that each of you gentlemen cater to have been allowed to become too big. Not too big to fail, as you've said in the past, but destined to fail because they are too big. They were smaller than a failure of one or even several of them could be contained. Now, young lady, let me finish. The brokers working for our largest financial service firms have plundered the average investor's portfolio, ravaged their bank accounts, and have destroyed the lives of our people, while the fat cats in Washington ride the coattails of the oligarchy's money grab. Rather strong stuff, Ken. Is that where we really are?"
Well, if you believe former President Jimmy Carter, who said last year that the United States is no longer a democracy, it's an oligarchy, yes. I think that's where we are. I mean, we're talking before, Sarah mentioned, the financial elite calling the shots, and it's basically their money gets legislation passed. People from their own industry, as we talked about before, get appointed to regulate the industry, which relaxes regulation and makes it easier for them to make more money. But the people that lose are the people who they're supposed to be protecting. And they pay for the advertising to elect whomever they want to put into office. So I think, that's what we really are right now.
Well, we're talking now again about Terror on Wall Street, and Harry Mason, Professor Mason, in the classroom is making a rather strong indictment of the current system, still believing there's hope to save the economy. Let's listen to what he says. He says, "Of course not. We have to act now while we still have a functioning economy to save. We've known for over 50 years that the financial industry has been methodically cheating the public by charging them for services that are worthless, is demonstrated by countless peer-reviewed studies by academia and their students. And we've known for at least 12 years that the banks are trading in almost unregulated and risky derivatives with notional values larger than the world economy. I believe that the banks and financial service industry take more than their fair share of our profits by using unfair business tactics. Now appears that our entire financial system has taken far more risk than is warranted by its capital structure, and this will lead to a market crash affecting economies worldwide. As for what we do, that part is up to you. I realize that Harry is talking to his classroom, but to both of you, is it up to us, the American people, and what on earth can we do? Sarah?
Well, it is up to the American people why we still have the opportunity to vote, although we have to get the average person or a larger percent of the average person to understand and to speak up. We have a paralysis in this country, and I don't know what percent it takes in order to make change, but, you know, maybe 8%, something like that. But we need to get enough people who have an understanding. And, you know, ignorance can be pretty dangerous. If they get a partial understanding, they're going to follow something. That's where an extreme leader can come in and take over, because ignorance can, where you know some of it, and then you just follow somebody who's charismatic, who's going to lead you on a pretty evil path. And so it takes a lot of courage at this point to make changes. We need major structural changes. And I actually think, you know, what happened with the hyperinflation in Germany is almost like akin to bankruptcy, you know, where you wipe out all your debts and they take everything from you and you start over. And it's just how they dealt with it was kind of an unethical way of dealing with it. And they didn't educate people on what was going on. But we really should be doing something akin to that, because do we really want to be in a situation where we're a slave to our debts for a century? You know, I mean, we're in that situation right now.
You know, when they got out of debt, when the hyperinflation was over, they issued a currency that I believe was backed by real estate in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, they backed it by something of value. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, Ken, having written the novel, what do you think we can do?
Well, I agree with Sarah. We need structural changes. And basically, we're talking about changes that have to occur with legislation. And that's just not going to happen right now, because the people who are basically running our Congress people are the ones that are causing the problem. So we need people to be more informed, as Sarah said. And like we've mentioned on other shows, Johnny, you and I, it really comes down to education. And you can't get all this the legislation we're talking about. I mean, we need to bring back Glass-Steagall. We need to revise the Dodd-Frank Act. We need to revise the Securities and Exchange Act, the Federal Reserve Act, the Lobbying Disclosure Act. I mean, we're talking about major changes that are going to put the people who are making the financial elite right now, in a tailspin, and they don't want it to happen. And the only way to happen is to get back control of our own democracy, basically, which only is going to happen by people being more informed.
Well, there's going to have to be some big things done, and I'm
like Sarah said, there has to be a big event that just forces all this to happen, which I hope is not going to be the case. But I don't see. You know, well, maybe. I mean, I'm kind of encouraged by, even though it's kind of weird and funny and a little bit scary, I'm kind of encouraged by, the people getting all involved in the political process, the average person. And, you know, we've got Bernie Sanders' rise on one side and Donald Trump on the other side, basically, because people are pissed off. They're worried. They want something to be shaken up. And these guys are both talking about shaking stuff up.
Well, you know, and I wonder, this is the first election where they actually talked, front runners actually talked about auditing the Federal Reserve. If there was transparency where we actually could audit the Federal Reserve to see what was really going on, then – you know, I wonder if something like that would be able to trigger getting the power of our democracy back in the hands of Congress and the people. I don't know, but something like that would have to happen where people could be educated, because frankly, none of us are really educated on what's really going on. And the Monetary Exchange Fund, that's another thing that's very secretive. And you can't make good decisions without knowing what's going on.
It is, and the IMF right now is the one that's basically solving all the financial crises in the European currencies, when one of the Euro nations starts to go down the tubes, they're the ones coming in and bailing them out. But like you said, we don't know the dynamics of that organization either.
From your book, Ken, I take it that if Wall Street is not involved in physical terrorism, it is in general waging a fiscal or financial war on the American people, making them constantly psychologically facing a threat of personal, national, even global disaster. Isn't this induction of grave psychological fear in the mass population a form of terror? Does Wall Street, by its current nature, need to provide this kind of disservice to the American people? Or is there a better way of actually helping America and the world sell stocks and bonds and other financial services? We have talked about the U.S. economy being saved. Can it actually be saved without saving Wall Street? Sarah?
Well, Wall Street is the financial juice for all of our corporations, or for corporations that are on Wall Street. So I think that we have to separate out the investments for companies, which is still important, and the investment firms that manage that. Does that make sense? The investment firms that manage that need to be completely restructured, and how we go about doing it. That control, we can't have criminal behavior. We can't have, but we still need to have means to invest in corporations, right? So we have to decouple what that means and how we go about doing that.
Ken, tell us your idea. What should we need to save Wall Street? Would we do it like Sarah suggests?
Oh yeah, we can't live without this engine. I mean, it's basically we depending on it. But I think what she said, these investment firms have been preying on the average investor for years, and they don't care whether the little guy makes money or loses money, as long as they make a commission. They're basically salesmen. I think a couple things have to be done. Number one, they have to have more responsibility toward the investor. Brokers have to be fiduciaries. They've got to be tested. They've got to have higher responsibilities. And I think the other thing is we've got to close that revolving door and stop the industry from regulating itself. That's the only way it's going to change.
Well, and also the corporations that are the companies, the businesses that need the money so that we can invest in innovation, the companies themselves are victims a lot of times. A big investment firm will bring a company to a market, and the company might get $100 million, and the investment firm gets $150 million. You know, I mean, think of how much more that company could have done if that money went in the pockets of the business. And so there's a lot of issues there, too. They're victims, too, a lot of these businesses. And those are the ones employing our people.
Well, Ken, now we're reaching sort of the end of the road here. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's going to be the beginning, hopefully. Why don't you tell us a little bit about How to Procure Terror on Wall Street and somewhat about your other two thriller series, which I've enjoyed some of them and we've discussed on this program before.
Yeah. Well, you can purchase all my books, my legal thrillers, my spy thrillers, and Terror on Wall Street on Amazon.com. Or you can go to my website, KennethE.com, KennethEade.com, and they're all there.
Sarah, why don't you tell us a little bit how to find Business Game Changers.
Yeah, you can find Business Game Changers. We're all over the place, but we air on Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time in New York, Rhode Island, and Connecticut on WBLQ. And then I also have my website, sarahwestall.com, which you can get all my podcasts there. All the radio shows are converted to podcasts. And then we're on 90-plus channels as well that you can get us on all the popular podcast channels. And I believe I'm also on YouTube through Transformation Talk Radio and Conscious Business Radio. But I am going to, if you let me, Johnny, I am going to take this program that we did today and re-air it. Obviously mine's only an hour and yours is 2 hours, so it'll take parts of it. But I'd love to re-air this.
That would be great.
Yeah.
This was
terrific.
A fun program, Johnny. No offense to you, but it was great to have this the dynamic going on with Sarah on the show. It was great.
Yeah,
well,
I had fun.
I hope we'll be able to do it again.
I hope you enjoyed that roundtable discussion as much as I enjoyed having the roundtable discussion. It was a lot of fun for me to be able to share everything that I've been talking about over the years. And we really do have some pretty big issues that we need to resolve in this country and globally. But in the meantime, I wanted to invite artists and people that have songs that they're introducing. I want to liven up my show a bit, especially in the commercial breaks. And I want to feature new artists and people that want to promote their songs. So if you get hold of me at, you can come to my website at sarahwestall.com and find my email address there. It's sarahw@galaxconsulting.com. Send me an email. I'd like to hear from you and see if you would like to feature some music on my show. So I hope everyone has an absolute wonderful day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.